This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode.
Okay, so it starts.
Whenever you're ready.
So, yes, it is. Nos conocimos en un tren de París a Barcelona. Íbamos sentados uno al lado del otro. Discutimos sobre quién usaría el enchufe del teléfono. Crash instantáneo. We met on a train from Paris to Barcelona. Sitting next to one another, we argued over who could use the power outlet. Désolé, je crois que c'est à moi. Sorry, I think it's mine. Instant crush. The beginning of our love story.
The trip lasted like 6 hours. We never stopped talking. Like, it was like, wow. We arrived and we didn't realize that we were just arriving.
We agreed to meet back in Paris. On March 19th, I'd wait for his train at Gare de Lyon railway station. We didn't know that coronavirus would confine us in different countries. Trusting in the power of the universe, we hadn't exchanged numbers. Parfois, le romanticisme ne suffit pas. A veces, un plan romántico no es suficiente. Sometimes, a romantic plan is not enough.
Lovely. Well, thank you so much, Cecilia.
No, thank you for your time and your interest in my story.
Bye-bye.
Bye, have a good day.
Hi, Mia.
Hey, Dan.
Do you have your seltzer?
I do have my seltzer.
Because you'll never love anyone but yourself.
And I love you more than
this week's essay is The Physics of Forbidden Love. It was written by Malcolm Connor, and it's read by MacLeod Andrews.
And Malcolm's essay was published in 2017 as a winner of our Modern Love College essay contest that we hold every couple of years that really serves as sort of a barometer for college kids and what they're dealing with emotionally and in relationships.
And for Malcolm at that time, I remember this was 4 months after Trump was inaugurated. Malcolm's essay really spoke to that moment.
Right. It resonated for that reason with a lot of people who were feeling similarly.
Yeah.
You can blame it all on Percocet. I was 3 days post-hysterectomy and a little loopy on painkillers. After 5 years of weekly testosterone injections, the canal, I can't stand calling it a vagina, much less referring to it as my, had atrophied to near non-existence. This made surgery difficult. I tore. The pain was bad enough. The fact that it was in an area of my body I had tried to ignore made me feel even worse. I had been treating the ache with Percocet at the cost of my lucidity. In a minor delirium, I developed a sudden need to tell a charismatic acquaintance, a girl from India in my physics class, just how beautiful and funny she was. It was winter break, and I was at home in Wisconsin, while she had remained in San Antonio, where we went to school. So I decided to send her a quick message. I ended up writing her a rambling letter. "Hey," I began, "you have cow eyes. I know that sounds like a bad thing, but have you ever looked into a cow's eyes? They are so deep and brown and beautiful. I've looked into a lot of cow's eyes because I'm from Wisconsin." After ruminating for another paragraph about cows and eyes, I wrote about how, when I squinted at the back of her head during physics, it looked as though the kinematic equations on the whiteboard were growing out of her hair. Finally, mercifully, I concluded by asking if she wanted to get together after the break. The next day, looking for her response, I found my letter as a new email in my own inbox. In my stupor, I had sent it not to her, but to myself. I didn't try to resend it. But when I saw her back at school, I couldn't resist telling the story of my misdirected, narcotics-fueled message. She laughed, then asked what surgery I'd had to get me on painkillers. "That's top secret," I said. "You need security clearance. I'm going to need fingerprint scans and your phone number." She gave me her number, but I didn't give her security clearance. No one at school knew I was transgender. I had transitioned at 15 and arrived at college with no intention of discussing my unusual childhood with my peers. So far, I had managed all right, but now that intention was on a collision course with my dating prospects. The more she and I flirted, the more I realized how unprepared I was to explain my history. Should I tell her bluntly or start from the beginning? What if she was angry or told the whole school? Listening to a friend boast of a recent hookup, I felt a bitter envy. How simple it must be to have a body that makes sense, that needs no explanation. After a few dates, I sat her down in the ornithology lab where I worked and tried to explain. Since she is pre-med, like me, I figured the simplest explanation was the medical one. How, at the start of high school, after years of feeling like a boy trapped in a girl's skin, I was told by my doctor that I had gender dysphoria, the product of a mismatch between body and brain. Although I tried to maintain a confident tone, I grew flushed and hot before I even managed to say the word transgender, and my voice grew so quiet that her growling stomach nearly drowned me out. When I was finished, she sat very still, the only sound a whirring centrifuge in the other room. I waited for her to get up and leave. She didn't. Taking my hand, she said, "I had no idea." In the flood of relief, I also felt a twinge of irritation. Of course she had no idea. I'm almost 6 feet tall, with a full beard and an Adam's apple that had once poked a girlfriend in the eye. What would have tipped her off? "I don't really care, I think," she continued. "Just tell me if I say something stupid, okay? I don't know a lot about it. I don't know anything, actually." For the next week, everything was fine. I was her first kiss. She fed me my first tiki puri. Then, one night, as we sat in her car, I learned that the biggest impediment to our relationship wasn't that I was a boy with two X chromosomes, but something much more commonplace. My heritage. Her parents, who had immigrated to Texas from India when she was 5, feared that their culture would be diluted and lost in America, so she was forbidden from dating anyone who was not Indian. With my Midwest accent, ratty Packers sweater, and frozen tilapia complexion, I was the antithesis of the son-in-law they hoped for. She hadn't told them about me and didn't know if she ever would. A more painful breakup later on seemed inevitable, so we agreed to stop seeing each other. I hoped that the rationality of the decision would offer comfort. It didn't. Soon enough, though, we drifted back to sitting with each other in physics. There, during a demonstration of magnetism, our professor pulled apart two neodymium discs, only to see them slide back together when she laid them on the table. We watched, took notes, and imitated. Within a week, she was back in my bed, It wasn't a decision. It was physics. Opposites doing what opposites do. After the first few days, when all I could think was how stupid we were being, our relationship had evolved into a surprisingly functional one, though with a few limitations. I couldn't post photos of us together online or talk in the background while she spoke to her parents on the phone. Once, she had to accessorize her temple apparel, a colorful traditional kurti, with an oatmeal-like woolen scarf to cover the hickeys I had carelessly left the night before. We went on muck-collecting expeditions to find anaerobic bacteria for her microbiology class. I found a way onto the roof of the student center where we would go to look at the stars. At first, I made jokes about how doomed we were, but as we grew closer, the jokes stopped being funny. She was truly unfazed by my transness. I exulted in this. It seemed as though I had finally cleared the last hurdle between me and the mundane heterosexual existence I had yearned for. Joking about reincarnation once, she said, "I must have had great karma to be a human in this life." "It couldn't have been that good," I said, "or I wouldn't have wound up in a girl's body." She rolled her eyes. "It's not a girl's body. It's yours." As we lay together at night, listening to the possum living in my ceiling scuffle back and forth, we initiated each other into our opposite and alien existences. I told her about the ordeals of my middle school years and the euphoria of my first testosterone shot, the suicides of friends, the post-transition balancing game pitting safety against loss of identity. And feeling homesick, I told her about walking on frozen Lake Monona and how the Wisconsin woods turn orange and then black and stay black for too long until you think you're going to die in the lonely cold before the ice ever melts, and how one day everything turns green. The trees and branches and trunks and even the boulders, too. She had never seen snow. I had never seen sugarcane fields. She told me about her grandparents' blue house in Gujarat, where she had lived while her parents tried to ground themselves in Texas, and the terror of the plane ride to meet them. 5 years old and flying to America in a cabin full of strangers. She attended weekly services at the local Hindu temple and would do her best to explain what had been talked about that day, despite my total religious ignorance. My favorite faux pas? Telling her we should name the elephant figurine on her dashboard Elfie McTrunkface. It turns out he already had a name. Lord Ganesh. She and I are still together, and we will almost certainly break up. Our relationship is based on mutual respect and trust, like any healthy pairing, but also on denial. She cannot marry me. We both know this, though I think she knows it better than I do. The foolhardy logic I use to rationalize my commitment to her will no doubt worsen my inevitable heartbreak, but for now it sustains me. As animosity toward brown-skinned immigrants seems to worsen daily in this political climate, and anti-transgender bills that strip me of my dignity draw closer to becoming law, there are days when we wake up scared, go to bed scared, and navigate our isolation in between. Why not find refuge, however finite and daring, with each other? In a time of such upheaval and uncertainty, our reckless, quiet love feels like deliverance.
Thank you.
This podcast is supported by Cartier.
For my 20th wedding anniversary, my husband gave me an amazing letter. We were having lunch in the park, the same park we got married in. And in the letter, he talks about all of the journeys and things that we've done. And he says, if I said to you, you were going to watch African sunrises from Ghana, if I said to you, you'll eat breakfast in Paris and sleep in the desert, dance in the streets of New Orleans or ride a camel, all while by my side, at the time, it would have seemed like a wild dream. But yet those dreams are in fact our memories. I cried like a baby when I read that letter. And I cry every time I read it. It made me feel in love. It made me feel in love.
With love, from Cartier.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
Hi, Malcolm.
Hi.
How are you doing?
It's going pretty well. How about you?
I'm doing well. Thank you. So, Malcolm, you wrote this essay in 2017. Are you two still together?
So, we are no longer together.
Hmm.
We did try to talk to her parents about the relationship, and they had their response was to basically say, well, you know, you can continue seeing him, but you'll no longer be a part of this family.
Wow.
Yeah. So there's not a lot of room for negotiation.
Hmm. And was that difficult for you?
So I mean, was it difficult to hear? Absolutely. It was also something that I think we'd both been preparing to hear mm-hmm. since the beginning. And so while it was really difficult, it also wasn't a surprise. And I had decided long before that conversation that if it ever did come to an ultimatum like that, I would not ask her to choose me because her family is her life.
Mm-hmm.
I loved her and I still love her, but it would be cruel, I think, to say, well, if you really loved me, you would give up your family.
Yeah. And what was that like for you to be in a relationship that you knew would have to end?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good question. It was definitely, in some ways, less scary than a regular relationship because it felt like, you know, from the beginning, we were sort of preparing for the end. And it made it so that every additional week, every additional day felt like we had, you know, succeeded in sort of stealing it from the universe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In a way, it made it easier because it felt like the inevitable breakup would not be either of our faults. I think in my past relationships, it, you know, that breakup came and even if you ended on good terms, you still felt like you'd done something wrong.
Failed in some way.
Right, yeah. Exactly. It was a failure, whereas this was an ending.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It makes total sense. Did you guys graduate at the same time?
We did, yeah. We're the same year. I hadn't seen her since we had officially broken up, and I wasn't sure what our dynamic was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I didn't see her actually during the ceremony, and afterward, you know, we're all kind of milling around outside, and I still hadn't seen her, and eventually, you know, my family was kind of getting antsy to go, and so we started walking away, and then I heard her shout my name and I was like, oh
my God. Yeah.
And I turn around and there she is and I'm like, oh. I remember kind of jogging over to her and she just breaks out in a smile and I break out in a smile and I give her this big hug and it was just like such a relief to be like, oh, we still really care about each other. And since then, we've actually, and if I sound surprised, it's because I guess I am a little bit surprised, have been able to develop a very strong and earnest friendship in that aftermath. And we, I am so happy and grateful that I can still call her a friend.
That's amazing. Well, thank you so much. Really, really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me. And it's always a pleasure to be asked questions that I wouldn't have been asking myself.
Bye, Malcolm.
Bye.
Modern Love is produced by Kelly Prime and Hans Buto and edited by Wendy Dorr. Music by Dan Powell.
This week's essay was written by Malcolm Connor and read by McLeod Andrews. Our tiny love story was written and read by Cecilia Passau.
Special thanks to Julia Simon, Nora Keller, Mahima Chablani, Laura Kim, Anya Strimian, Sam Dolnick, Corey Sika, Bonnie Wortham, and also to Ryan Wegner and Kelly Rogers at Autumn.
The executive producer of New York Times Audio is Lisa Tobin.
I'm Mia Lee.
And I'm Dan Jones.
Thank you for listening.
See you next week.